So while I've been talking to speakers for our first panel, which is entitled Challenges in Investigating and Prosecuting at the International Level. I should say at this point, we were hoping to have three speakers, but unfortunately the third speaker was unable to come because of a family emergency. So, obviously. But I have utter confidence in the two speakers that we do have here. So, a very brief introduction to them both. We haven't talked about order. Patty Sellers, which is the order on the programme. Patty Sellers has, in a sense, already been introduced by Michelle a moment ago. Patty was with the ICTY literally from the outset, from 1993, and was appointed by the then prosecutor, Richard Goldstone, essentially as the gender advisor to the ICTY. Since she has left the ICTY, she has been special advisor for prosecution strategies to the prosecutor at the ICC, the International Criminal Court, and has been an expert consultant to a whole range of different UN bodies on issues relating sexual violence and armed conflict, children in armed conflict, women's human rights, investigations, and also teaching as an academic in Oxford, for example. So, Patty. Max is a criminal prosecutor and investigator, again has extensive experience in the international justice sector, prosecuting attorney at the ICTY, investigating attorney in the special court for Sierra Leone. So one of the things we're also aiming today is to bring from different courts experiences and ideas. She was on the UN Commission of Inquiry for Guinea, and an advisor to the UK's PSVI initiative. So, each will speak for about 20 minutes, and then there'll be again further time for discussion. So, Patty,
right. Over to you. Thank you very much, Christine. I'd like to congratulate you on the formation of the center and on this conference. And probably a little known, but a well-deserved tidbit that we should all be aware of is that Christine Schenken wrote the first amicus brief for the ICTY that concerned witness protection. And as a matter of fact, that's how we met. It was a prosecutor-propelled brief where I asked Christine, we're going to argue that for witness protection for Tadic, that the witness needs confidentiality, and would you take the stance that the witness needs to be anonymous? And so Christine, as an excellent international criminal lawyer, argued that the witness should be anonymous because there was no witness protection in Tadic. And we, the prosecutors, looked so reasonable. We were only arguing confidentiality. These little civil, society briefs were coming in. And the judges ruled for anonymity. The point was won. And that brought a lot of controversy outside of the ICTY, a lot of happiness inside of the Office of the Prosecutor. And to relate compelling this brief was, is that most people thought, once again, it was political correctness due to feminism or women. But the anonymity was applied to male sexual assault survivors, not female sexual assault survivors. And so I would like to bring up that bit of history because history is lost too frequently, and those who make history go forward are also lost. So thank you, Christine, for beginning us off with the Tadic in that very spectacular way. I do have to say that today the ICTY and other courts do have a witness protection program, and that anonymity is no longer sought as one of the protective measures. The second thing I would like to say is that I know that very few people have had a chance to completely read this book. I've read most of the chapters. I think only the authors have read the entire chapters. And they're not allowed necessarily to wave their own banner. I think that this is a crucially important, exceedingly crucially important book that has come out for international criminal law. As you know, most people are the heroes in their autobiographies. this book does not make the ICTY the hero. It makes it the institution that has lived through the challenges to get to where it is today. It is a book authored by, basically, feminist international criminal lawyers, including the male prosecutor. It is a book that has shown how one can frequently make mistakes and not be afraid to make them in order to get to an outcome that reaches toward justice, and particularly not only for victims, but for the international community on whose behalf the prosecutor is supposed to bring the cases. In writing this book, Michelle did talk about it took 6 years. Well, when you read this book, you're going to think that that was awful quick. Because I can imagine the arguments that must have taken place between colleagues. How much do we reveal? How much do we not reveal? Should we really put that in? Do we want people to think that we made that mistake again and again? It's a brave book. I would ask you not only to buy it, take your time to go through it. It's a book that speaks to the prosecutor, but also speaks to the scholar. One of the best footnoted books, one of the best recitation of cases that you can use. But it's a very human book. It's a book that really allows you to understand that behind it, it did take human beings. Unlike most international criminal law books, it uses we, our. We looked at it this way. We thought about it that way. And then we rethought. It's very accessible. And then the last thing I'd like to mention about the book, a type of understatement, and it's for the future book, and I know that all of you authors are exceedingly tired, but within the next 5 years, there has to be a book on the appellate processes at international courts and tribunals. It's part of the missing story. And I think as feminist international criminal lawyers, we don't understand that it's not just finding the witness, the document, it's not just preparing the case for trial, presenting the case at trial, winning or losing the trial. The process continues at the appellate level. And if we didn't have strong international criminal lawyers and feminist international criminal appellate lawyers, the process would never be completed in terms of presenting to the judiciary the case for sexual violence, gender-based violence, and just gender as part of how we have to look at international crimes. So that's the end of my advertisement and my slide. Now I'll get to the presentation. What I'd like to talk about in terms of the investigation of sexual violence or gender-based crimes is the interrelationship of the narrative, the story that we all know what happened, with the investigation and the presentation of the evidence in the crime. And I'd like to cite out three different examples. The first will be the Cambodia Tribunal, just to shift a tiny bit from the International Criminal Tribunal for the former Yugoslavia. In Cambodia, for years, I would say up to 30 years, the conventional wisdom was that the Khmer Rouge had committed a genocide that had touched at least 2 million lives, and meaning that 2 million people were dead. And this narrative took on a life of its own. The narrative was so strong that it was thought that the Khmer might have been bloodthirsty in terms of their killing, but they were puritanical in terms of sexual violence. They killed, but they didn't rape. And so there were a couple of, I wouldn't call them commissions, but certain authors who went to kind of record this story and perpetuate what was later revealed to be a myth. When the extraordinary criminal chambers of Cambodia were set up and the investigators started to investigate, they were almost instructed by the prosecutors or by the investigators who were higher placed that, look, this is what happened. They just killed everyone, you know, but there's no sexual violence. We don't have to worry about that. If one were now to look at the role of civil society in international criminal litigation, and if one were to question, well, do we really need this, you know, partie civile? Do we need this third party, which we didn't have at Yugoslavia, that does exist at the International Criminal Court? Do they really have a role to play? Well, at the Extraordinary Criminal Chambers of Cambodia, it was the civil party that not only encouraged the investigating judges and the Office of the Prosecutor, so subsequently the investigators at the Office of the Prosecutor and the investigating judges, that the Cambodian narrative was incorrect. And it was incorrect because sexual violence was an innate part of the Cambodian genocide, and because gender-based violence, how you treated men, women, boys, girls, could not be separated from the genocide. But first, let's clarify. What was the genocide? The court decided that the genocide, in essence, were the killings of the two subgroups, meaning the Muslim-based Cambodians and the Vietnamese immigrants to Cambodia. Those were the two groups that were related to genocide groups in Cambodia, and that the monks who were Cambodian were also submitted to a genocide. So therefore, due to religion and due to ethnic status, these three groups were the real groups who had been targeted for genocide. The majority of Cambodians who were Buddhists were not the subject of genocide. They were the subject of crimes against humanity. But what about the sex? Where does that come in? Well, it came in ways that we didn't necessarily see in Yugoslavia. It came in with the forced marriages between Cambodians, where both males were forced to have sexual relations with women who they often didn't know, and women were forced to have sexual relationships with men whom they didn't necessarily know. And that was considered to be a forced marriage. Now, was this a discovery that, you know, one lone investigator who went out being instructed by a brave prosecutor took on? No, as I mentioned, civil society just brought forward the common knowledge among many Cambodians that forced marriage occurred rampantly. The estimates, and I don't like the numbers game, was up to 400,000 people were forced to be married often, and ceremonies where hundreds of people were at the ceremonies. Now, was this a hidden fact, or was this only an orally conducted fact? No, when one goes into the archives, the DCAM archives of Cambodia, it's been written down. Not necessarily the marriage records, but the fact that so-and-so was forced to get married with so-and-so, or the forced marriages took place. It was the public secret. But because we believe the narrative that there was no sexual violence, it limited the investigation into, in quotes, the Cambodian genocide or the crimes against humanity. And there was another part of this narrative. And the narrative was that neither the Cham, the Muslim minority, or the Vietnamese minority were sexually violated. They were killed. And we all know that genocide entails killings. But there was evidence that many of the women were raped prior to being killed. And so should this have fallen out of the act of genocide? Well, when one goes back to Akiyesu, one understands from the Rwanda tribunal that the raping of peoples prior to their death basically entails two acts of genocide. The act of causing serious vital mental harm to the person who's a member of the group, and then the killing. So when we look at Cambodia, again, we could say, well, even if we see a narrow version of the genocide, of the killing of the Cham and the Vietnamese, what about the raping of those women prior to being killed? That enlarges our sphere of the genocide. But when we really have a gendered perspective on the genocide of Cambodia, and we bring in Srebrenica, we now understand from Srebrenica that the genocide occurred in many different ways. First of all, we could just count the male bodies, 7,000, 8,000, horrific, horrendous. But when the court specifically looked now to see what happened to the men and boys who ended up being dead and those who survived, our gender analysis is much more sophisticated. We've understood that those males who had the luck to survive by either playing dead or being buried under bodies, suffered causing serious bodily mental harm to those members of the group who were to be executed but survived. And we take that from a gendered understanding of the notion of that act of genocide from Akiyesu and apply it to Srebrenica. But later, the Srebrenica, what I call a subbody of Srebrenica jurisprudence, says that even the men who were killed prior to being killed suffered serious mental harm, knowing that they were being separated out to be killed. And that we have to look at what happened to those males, their gendered aspect of the genocide prior to the death, and we have to look at those aspects of those males who survived the execution. And so causing serious and bodily mental harm is attached to them now through the Srebrenica sub-jurisprudence, and we should put that over into the jurisprudence of Cambodia, so that the Cham men, the Vietnamese men, prior to their death, had an act, a gendered act of genocide that occurred to them, as well as those who might have survived. But what about the Buddhist monks, that other third category of genocide? Well, certainly killing them was an act of genocide. Prior to their death, being taken from their religious sanctuaries, was that not causing mental harm to members of the group, a la Srebrenica? Certainly. But some of the Buddhist monks were forced to marry and were not killed. So could we look at the acts that occurred to those Buddhist monks, those who survived, weren't even attempted to be killed? Was that an act of genocide because they were trying to get rid of the religious nature of a group, in particularly those monks? Was that not also maybe an act of causing serious mental harm to members of that group? Some were killed, some were forced to get married and no longer be Buddhist, to de-religify them of their Buddhistness. All of this implies on how we investigate and how we understand a gendered nature of a genocide or crimes against humanity. Now, this same type of analysis can be done with the Guatemalan genocide. We can look again at different aspects of the genocide that has been pleaded, although the court didn't agree, in the former Yugoslavia in the Karadzic case. I want to bring up just one other aspect, a gendered aspect of genocide that ties directly to investigation. And the relationship that the prosecuting attorney and the investigator have in order to be able to see what might actually be right in front of them that seems to be occluded. And that occurs in the media case that came out of the Rwanda tribunal. We know in the media case that for the first time, the charge of direct and public incitement to commit genocide was brought forward and prevailed not only at the trial level, but also at the appellate stage. And part of the evidence of the direct and public incitement to commit genocide entailed sexualized propaganda against Tutsi women, such as, you know, Tutsi women think they're too haughty, we need to rape them, Tutsi women, et cetera, but the sexualized propaganda. And when we understand that direct and public incitement to commit genocide is what I call one of the family of genocide crimes, the Genocide Convention gives us five crimes: genocide, conspiracy to commit genocide, complicity in genocide, attempt to commit genocide, direct and public incitement to commit genocide. That those are the part of the genocide crimes that work toward the prevention. We're supposed to prevent genocide, and where it occurs, you know, suppress it and punish it. This is part of the prevention. So when someone is publicly and directly inciting genocide, the duty is to prevent it, and the crime occurs irrespective of whether a subsequent genocide occurs. Hopefully, a subsequent genocide doesn't occur, that we've caught it in time, such as with the attempt. The question is this, or excuse me, not the question, the point I'm trying to make, is that when we look at how we can demonize sexually a population, whether they be females, whether they be girls, whether they be boys or men, with an intent to destroy that group in whole or part. And we have an obligation to prevent that, prevent a genocide that's occurring. Investigating the demonization, and particularly in this instance, the sexualized demonization of persons, not only seems to be an obligation, but seems to be something that an investigator has to understand is already evidence potentially of a genocide that might occur, a type of precursor. The prosecuting attorney and the investigator have to understand that this evidence is not just rallying, are not just empty words, and it's not just hate speech. The difficulty is that we become in many ways very accustomed to sexual demonization, and we become very accustomed to saying, well, nothing really bad happened. And when we talk about genocide, something bad has to happen, meaning we count the bodies. And so one of the biggest things I think that we've learned from the ICTY, from the ICTR, that we can from Cambodia in the future, is that genocide in its gendered form is not about, and is least about, just counting male bodies. Investigators and prosecutors, I think, in the future will be working at an entirely different level. But why? It's because genocide, doctrinally, is much more complex than just the first act of killing. And if it is to safeguard and protect us, a gendered population, we have to understand the depths of its gendered contours. Thank you.
Max, please.
Thank you. So I'm an optimist by nature, and I'm not likely to say that anything is impossible, but saying anything that contributes anything after Patty Sellers,
yes,
is pretty close to impossible. So I thank you for this challenge.
Yes.
I hope I can. If you don't mind, I'm going to go over there so as to protect the stewards from having to deal with all the materials. Okay, well, I want to start just by thanking you all for the invitation. I would like to celebrate the incredible publication. I want to convey my immense admiration and respect for my colleagues, former colleagues. And, you know, it's amazing to see this product because it can be such a useful tool. You know, everywhere that we go, I'm sure all of you are, you know, ICTY is the mothership. Right? So the mothership. And then they all say, so how was it done? You know, and you give anecdotes, but you've pulled it all together. So I think the broader impact of this is going to be something that we will see the ripple effects of very, very widely globally. So you should all be very, very, very proud. So as somebody with the cup half full version of the world, I asked myself, how are we going to talk about success? What does success mean? What do we mean when we say that we had a success or a failure? And so I'm putting up two questions, basically. One is, how do we define success in terms of accountability for sexual violence crimes? And how do we partner with our peers in order to increase the transformative potential of criminal justice? That's actually something that we haven't talked about in the past. We've separated out different parts of transitional justice. There's the criminal justice part, the truth-seeking part, the memorialization part, the reparations part, and the guarantees of non-recurrence part. It's been separated out. But how do we actually make it a more holistic process? And it's critical that we find ways to do that because in many circumstances, there is no opportunity to do all of those things. There are no resources, there's no time, and there's nobody who can put in place all those things that are necessary following a conflict. So I'm going to tackle the first question. How do we define success? So Michelle and Patty both talked a little bit about this. You know, we wanted standalone charges of sexual violence, right? Right, Patty? We wanted standalone charges. We didn't want, at the beginning, sexual violence to be prosecuted as torture or under any other category because it diminished the importance of the unique character of that kind of an act. That's what we wanted. So we fought for it and we got it. And now, looking back, what happened? You know, I think whenever I talk about this, I think about Rhonda. And I wonder so much what she would say, you know. So I just want to take a moment to think about Rhonda, who was at the forefront of pushing for these, with both of you, pushing for these itemized crimes. Okay, and Rhonda continues to inspire us. So we highlighted the unique nature of the harm. We got standalone charges, and now basically we fed away. For it to be separated and taken out from the whole pattern of atrocities, right? We in a way, I don't think it was the wrong thing to do. I'm just saying that because we didn't change the underlying perceptions, we ended up with the opposite of, I think, what we wanted. We wanted the unique nature of these harms to be documented and prosecuted and acknowledged. But in the end, we highlighted the sexualized nature of it, which ended up triggering all the discriminatory and misogynist systems that exist. And that is why, and that is one of the paths that was paved toward these judgments that sort of surgically remove the sexual component from the foreseeable crimes that are likely to be committed. The sexual violence crimes are out, right? And so the question is, why did that happen that way? And how do we define success? What else do we want? We wanted special treatment, right? We wanted special treatment and protection for sexual violence. We wanted specialized groups to do the investigation. We wanted specialized protective measures. We wanted specialized procedures in court. We got a lot of that, and some of that has been absolutely fundamental to any of the justice successes that we have seen. But we also, in so doing and in talking so much about the stigma and the trauma and the impact and the re-traumatization, we ended up in some ways suggesting a very weak survivor made of glass cowering in the corner who, no matter what, we're going to harm, and we have to do something to not break her. And so we inadvertently fueled a certain amount of disempowerment. And some of this is a learning process, right? I mean, I'm saying we because we are in this community of sexual violence justice practitioners. And we have fought for things, and they haven't exactly always worked out the way we wanted them to work out. So I am a cup half full person. I do think that the standalone sexual violence charges are critical. I do think that highlighting the violence and not highlighting the sexual component is one of the challenges we face. And I don't think the answer is to not have itemized standalone charges. But we have, these are the challenges that we're facing right now everywhere we go. So one of the ways I think that we can help in terms of the empowerment is to listen very, very carefully to the victims, to the survivors, and what they say, what they want, and how they define what is success, what is their goal, what do they think. And this goes to some of the questions that were just raised just before. I want to tell one anecdote on this. There was one survivor in one place where I was working who was not approached because there was an immense concern amongst my colleagues that approaching this particular survivor would be very, very extremely damaging. And this was the notes that were available with respect to the survivor basically said the survivor should not be approached. Do not approach. The medical indications are that the trauma is so severe that approaching this survivor will cause irreparable harm. Now, that all of those notes were done out of exactly what we want, which is a concern for the survivor and prioritizing the survivor over the evidence. That's exactly what we want, right? We want the well-being of the survivor to be prioritized. So it was a good thing that those notes were there. But we faced a situation where there had to be some litigation on this issue. And because there had to be some litigation, somehow the survivor had to be spoken to, even if not approached to tell the story. And I approached the survivor, and after a certain amount of time talking and catching up, basically, she said, okay, so why are you here? And I said, oh, well, you know, to see how you are. No, okay, why are you here? Okay, so, well, you know, there's this case. When do you want me? I'll be there. When do you want me? I'll be there. And I said, but isn't it going to be difficult for you? And isn't it going to be traumatic? And wouldn't your doctors advise against it? Oh, yeah. I mean, you can go and talk to my doctors, and they are going to tell you that I should not do this. But they killed my mother, and they killed my brother. You tell me when to be there, and I will be there. Now, okay. And the witness testified brilliantly and had some, a bit of a relapse, but said basically the relapse was to be expected. This is how my life is. I live with this. I live with this trauma. It wasn't more exacerbated by this or that. I want to participate in justice. I know it's only one story, and it may have gone the other way around, okay? But the point is that the choice is one of the affected community, right? It's their choice. And in all of these protections that we put in place, we shouldn't infantilize and carry it too far so as to take away the choice of the survivors. So we talk about do no harm. I don't know how many of you are in the humanitarian field. In the humanitarian field, the standard of do no harm is sort of like this ultimate standard. When you're dealing with survivors of sexual violence, do no harm, do no harm. And Patty and I were also talking about this. Why is do no harm the highest standard? If that's the highest standard, then for goodness sake, I mean, the highest standard has to be, that's the lowest standard. Okay, do no harm, at least do no harm, right? At a minimum. So I'm strongly in favor of us changing it. I mean, I say that the highest standard is empowerment. You can term it any other way, but we have to have some other kind of very high, I think, standard to go for rather than just doing no harm. I'd like to talk about a couple of examples of successes. And this is the Hisan Habre case. This judgment, the trial judgment, was rendered on the 30th of May. And this is a picture. I'm sorry for the quality. I had to sneak the camera in the courtroom. So, you know, that's what I could get. But, you know, so Hisan Habre is sitting there. He's the guy all wrapped up. He's protesting the proceedings. And, you know, this is a trial against the former president of Chad. And the trial took place in Senegal after 15 to 20 years of civil society victims fighting for justice. You know, I mean, and it just, I don't even know where to begin on the impact of this. You know, it is in sub-Saharan Africa. It's the extraordinary African chambers endorsed by and set up by under an instruction from the African Union. You know, and we all talk about Kenya, and we talk about Africa and African governments being against the ICC, et cetera, et cetera. And in the meantime, in Senegal, they're getting on with the trial of Hisan Habre, the former president of Chad, who was just convicted at the end of May for crimes, including crimes of sexual violence, including crimes of sexual violence, including sexual slavery. Now, I want to give you one video of one witness testifying. I didn't know how to handle the whole translation thing, so I'm going to tell you what's going on here, and then you can watch this one-minute clip. This is an elderly woman. Mind you, okay, these crimes happened in the 70s and 80s. Okay, the crimes happened in the 70s and 80s, right? It's 30 plus years since the crimes happened. Clearly, the evidence of sexual violence is testimonial evidence, right? And that's it, right? Okay, the judge, there's a witness, a survivor there, who was held in the presidency building for three and a half months in the presidency building, raped by Hissène Habré, the president, and a whole bunch of other people over that period of time. She was not alone. There was a group of them. She did not tell in her first statements about the rapes because she said to them at the time, I'm not going to tell you the whole story now until I'm face to face with Habré at his trial. But remember, this is like a civil law system inherited from France, right? So you have the procès-verbal, all the evidence has to be given in advance before the investigating judge. You can't pop brand new evidence at trial. It's not part of the procedure. But because she had said, I'm not going to tell you the whole story, she was allowed to tell the story because she had already announced that there was something else. And she told the story, but she was obviously subjected to very, very difficult examination and cross-examination because this was the first mention and because she was accusing the president, the accused, directly of sexual violence. Rape. Okay. So the judge is trying to get information from her about the rapes. By the way, there's two judges from Senegal and one judge from Cameroon, I think. Cameroon? Okay, another country, okay. Asking what kind of torture she suffered apart from the electrocution, apart from the whipping, apart from the choking and the beating. What other kind of torture did she suffer? You were held in the presidency building for 3 months and 15 days. What happened there? Okay, and she basically says, look, I'm an old woman. I can't speak these things. And the judge says, you did not say that you were raped. Do you want to go into closed session? We can go into closed session. We have to know what happened there. And she says, I have nothing to hide. And this is the part I'm going to show you. I have nothing to hide, okay? I don't need closed session. I have nothing to hide. If you want, I can take off my clothes and show you exactly what was done. They slept with me. They raped me. I have nothing to hide. And the judge says, no, please don't misunderstand. We need to hear your explanation and hear what happened so that it can be recorded, so that later when we are deliberating, we can base our judgment on concrete evidence. So this is, remarkable, right? The judge saying, your words, we need to hear them because that's going to be the concrete evidence on which we're going to base our judgment. Okay,
Non, je n'ai rien caché. Ils ont couché avec moi. Je n'ai rien à cacher, moi. Je peux même me déshabiller là. On m'a violé. Je n'ai rien à cacher.
Madame, attendez, calmez-vous. En fait, vous voyez, notre travail aussi, c'est de comprendre ce qui s'est passé. Et c'est pour cela qu'on pose certaines questions pour que cela puisse ressortir. Parce que ce que vous dites là, tout est enregistré. Et nous voulons que ce que vous dites aussi et vos explications puissent être enregistrées pour que au moment où on va juger, au moment où on va rendre notre décision, qu'on s'appuie sur des preuves concrètes.
Okay, thank you. So she had to go through very brutal cross-examination, very, very brutal. And it's the kind that churns your stomach. I guess we would have to ask. I mean, I understand why she needed to be examined, but do they need to go that far? However, she withstood it, and in the judgment, well, there was a summary of the judgment. the chamber found, and sorry, this is my unofficial translation, the chamber recalls firstly that the testimony of a victim of sexual violence does not need to be corroborated. With respect to the testimony of Kadia Hassan Zidane, the chamber analyzed it meticulously, in particular in light of the arguments of the parties. The evidence of Kadia Hassan Zidane, which implicates Hissein Habre in the rapes committed against her, is not only coherent in and of itself and with respect to her previous statements, but is also supported by the evidence of another detainee whose testimony the chamber considered very credible. Kadia Hassan Zidane clearly explained the reasons for her silence. Apart from modesty, she was afraid and ashamed. In addition, she was waiting until she could face Hissein Habre face-to-face during his trial to explain everything without shame. The chamber is convinced that she speaks the truth. The convictions followed. After 15 years, the justice was rendered in an African hybrid court under the system of Senegal. Talk about a success. Now, I should just add one thing. 10% of the budget, the total budget for this court was $8.5 million. 10% was for outreach. They had live streaming of the entire proceedings all throughout the communities, all throughout Chad and Senegal. So there was an extensive investment in bringing the community into the justice process. I want to talk about, quickly about one more success. You mentioned Guatemala, Patty. Guatemala is another context in which more than 30 years after the crimes were committed, there's been justice brought. We had the first conviction for sexual slavery as an international crime brought in the national courts in February. This was also the process, a very, very lengthy process of advocacy by civil society mainly. And finally, an opening opened up politically and the case was brought. Some of the victims died before trial, but their depositions had been taken previously, and that came into evidence. This is the first time that the indigenous Mayan communities came to the high court for a case that was about sexual violence. None of them testified in person during the trial. Their evidence came in through their prior depositions. So here are a few pictures. This is a picture outside the courthouse. I mean, the affected communities came from all over the country to the courtroom and gave words of support. This is them inside the courthouse. You have to understand, this is not normally the sight that you see in the courthouse. It's really, really remarkable. This is the courtroom. You see the women, let's see, where's the pointer? Okay, these are the prosecutors here, up to here. These are the civil parties, the civil party lawyers, and these are the victims. And we can talk a little bit afterwards, not to take too much time about the covering of the head. There's a long story about that. So how we talk about what we're doing really also impacts upon what we view as a success. This is probably the only case of this kind that this community will have. They're old, the perpetrators are old, the victims are old, time is passing, okay? And so if the broader community doesn't feel a sense of ownership and justice, and feel if the justice is not transformative on a larger community scale, then they won't have access to justice in any other way, right? Another success that I want to talk about, for example, and this is really a good example of how we talk about successes, is Kosovo. In Kosovo, it's been said to me that sexual violence, by internationals working there, it's been said that the sexual violence crimes are not likely to be brought there, that people won't come forward, people don't want to talk, especially about the ethnic aspect, and that we've had two cases in ULEX. ULEX is the internationalized justice system. It's really an international justice system sitting in Kosovo. It's not very hybrid in practice. And that we've had two cases only of sexual violence that have gone actually through the system, and the one that's reached the Supreme Court ended in an acquittal. And so it's cited as a failure. So I said, well, let me look at this case that's cited as a failure. Let's look at what it says. And when you look at the case, you find that actually, okay, yes, that there was an acquittal because of a suspect identification problems. The identification, the photo identification procedures were not done well. But you have very, very helpful jurisprudence that's in that judgment. Jurisprudence about discrepancies in witness statements, not necessarily impugning the statement. The court should not treat every minor discrepancy of a particular witness statement as discrediting its probative value as a whole, where that witness has nevertheless recounted sufficiently the essence of the indictment in satisfactory detail. And similarly, and a very helpful part on the Supreme Court of Kosovo considers that the mere lack of medical report does not indicate that the rape did not take place. Medical reports are to be expected under normal circumstances. However, in the case at hand, the lack of medical report is well justified by the circumstances of the armed conflict that prevailed at the material time. Now, from the ICTY perspective, we think this is, of course, very obvious. But everywhere where I'm going and I'm working, I'm mentoring prosecutors and investigators in their national jurisdictions. And everywhere I go, they come up with the same exact problems. We only have witness evidence. We don't have any other evidence. We don't have medical documents. The witnesses can't remember exactly the dates or the ages. They're repeating the same challenges, which is why I think this book is going to be so helpful to them. They all, everywhere, in Guatemala, in Kenya, everywhere where I go, they're actually facing exactly the same kinds of problems. So why in Kosovo would they view this as a failure rather than a success? You already have a Supreme Court judgment that supports these two issues. So I think it's really about the narrative, isn't it, right? So I want to wrap up with one more anecdote. We have a lot of choices. We at ICTY had a lot of choices. And our counterparts in national jurisdictions don't have those choices. As I said, the resources are limited, the perpetrators and victims are aging, the information security systems are non-existent. Witness protection is either non-existent or corrupted. The legal codes are not necessarily adequate. And the access to jurisprudence from outside is very, very limited for certain languages. You cannot just look up international jurisprudence unless you speak the languages in which the international jurisprudence is published. So the problem is that in these circumstances, any criminal justice proceeding is important, and its importance is magnified in these kinds of circumstances, because one case or two cases or three cases may be the only justice that community ever sees. That was the case in Sierra Leone as well. We had the four cases, and that was it. There is no national justice process for war crimes or crimes against humanity, none. So it had to be something that was accessible and that the community was included in. Otherwise, there was no chance for anybody to have access to justice or to feel that sense of reparative, restorative, transformative justice. So in international criminal justice doesn't mean that we're prosecuting the crime somewhere else. International means these are cross-border crimes which have impact on all humanity, right? So international criminal justice is international crimes are crimes not because it's being somewhere outside, but because all of us are victims and any of us can prosecute it. That's the origin of the term, right? Crimes against all of humanity. That's where universal jurisdiction comes from. Anybody can prosecute it anywhere. So the more we partner with our colleagues in national jurisdictions to combat impunity, the more we're really contributing to accountability in a much more holistic and organic way. So the last example I want to give is one from Sierra Leone. In Sierra Leone, we were not given a narrative of what happened. We were not told this is what happened and therefore go investigate it. We were given an open plan to investigate what happened there. And we were not limited by what was published in Human Rights Watch reports, which was predominantly only one side's crimes and not the other side. And in doing this investigation, and because it was a field-based investigation with mixed teams, a hybrid model with Sierra Leonean investigators and international investigators together, hand in hand, we were not bound by any narrative or even by our assumptions, because we were learning every moment what the context was. And over time, we realized that in addition to sexual slavery, there was also the crime of forced marriage. Now, I know we all know about the jurisprudence that came out on forced marriage, but back at the time when we first found this evidence, we realized there were two separate criminal patterns, the pattern of sexual slavery and the pattern of forced marriage. But sexual slavery was an enumerated crime, and forced marriage was not. We also knew, that if we brought forced marriage, and I say knew because we were 100% sure, that if we charged forced marriage, we would lose. And not only lose, we would probably set the jurisprudence back by a certain amount of, right? And just very, very controversial, right? But we said, it's not for us. Right? It's not for us. So we brought together a very broad array of people from the community. I don't know, some of you have heard me tell this story before, but this is really a pivotal story for me in my career. We brought together an array of victims and women mostly, but some men from the community. We brought old and young, educated and illiterate. We brought from different ethnic and tribal backgrounds, different regions, different roles in society, and there were a huge number of them in the room. And we basically said, okay, here's the situation. We've been investigating these crimes, and we see that there's a pattern of sexual slavery that kind of looks like this, and there's been a pattern of forced marriage that kind of looks like this. If we can charge it all as sexual slavery, because it would all meet the definition, and then we have a better chance of winning. That's our guess. We can't control it, but we're just telling you what our thought process is. We have a better chance of winning. However, if we charge forced marriage, it describes perhaps better what happened to those women, to the bushwives, etc., quote unquote, but we have a very big chance of losing and possibly of setting back the law. Now, we can't do what you're asking. We can't guarantee that we would do what you're asking, but we don't want to even decide without you telling us what your view is. What do you want? And I mean, all of us predicted that they would say, let's just do it as sexual slavery because we want a conviction, right? Because that's how we define success. Of course, there's no guarantee that way either. They all, I mean, without exception, they all said you have to bring forced marriage because this is our only chance to get this story told in this way. And we don't care if we lose. We want it to be told accurately because that's what we suffered. And that's what we want to do. Now, of course, we ended up with good jurisprudence, but that was really, even the consultation, even, you know, had we not charged forced marriage after that consultation, right, you still would have had shown a respect for the community. There was nothing lost. There was only a gain by including them in the process. And so we have this the nice jurisprudence that on appeal conviction for forced marriage. And I don't think, Patty, if we had defined the narrative ourselves, we would have proceeded the same way or come to the same conclusions, right? We asked the affected community what is their narrative. Mm-hmm. And we were influenced heavily by their narrative. So to conclude, who defines what is a success is really the better question. Right? So how do we define success? It doesn't really matter how we define a success. But I do think we have to have a broader vision of it and listen to those for whom the justice is brought. It's not for us, it's for the survivors. So, and I feel very strongly that it's our obligation to include them and consult in making our decisions. So the highest standard then, empowerment through justice, or I'm sure you can think of a better term, but basically we discard the do no harm as the lowest standard. The justice is for the communities. It has to be owned by them. It should be as nationalized or localized as feasible. The post-conflict communities have a right to be partners in the design and implementation of the justice mechanism. They have a right to a justice process which adapts to them to the extent possible. An empowering and transformative experience with the justice process independent from the outcome of the case. I'm just going to show the video of the judgment in the courtroom. That's fine, yeah, Abrey.
Isen Abrey. La chambre condamne à la peine d'emprisonnement à perpétuité.
If you want the links, I can use your links. And then the judgment in the Seprosarco case in Guatemala. From February.
We are very satisfied for the life and dignity of these women. The verdict was important for the country as well as the entire world. I think the most important thing.
Thank you.
Two amazing talks with a lot of different ideas that people may want to take up. I think particularly around this whole idea of narrative and how do we unpack narrative, whose narrative, who does the narrative belong to, how do we unpack it, and what's the role of gender in a sort of, well, I think you used the expression, a very deep understanding of gender, right, to try and unpack the different narratives and choices. I think that was the other big theme that came out from both of you. But I'm sure people have got lots of comments, questions. Patty, maybe unless there's anything you want to say first, in response.
Yeah, one thing I think it's very important, I'm happy you brought up the Hissine Habré trial. And I didn't realize that the woman had said, I'll speak to him when I'm in front. But at the same time, one has to go back a little bit to that question of narrative. For 30 years, the story was that there was horrendous detention and torture, but there was no sexual violence. And then, you know, a la Akayesu, she gets on the stand and says, so there's sexual violence, and that there was a coalition of amicus writers who got together and put forward a brief to the court to say, look, can we allow in the evidence of sexual violence, and can we allow it as a charge? And it goes back to, I think, a vital point that you'll see in this book of, you know, coming in 10 days too late, you know, 10 dimes too short, full of anger, but with no judicial pathway. Whereas here the court did find a judicial pathway. And so I would say not only to offices of the prosecutors, but for civil society organizations, Human Rights Watch followed that case for 20 to 25 years. And I think, you know, as investigators, I don't think I personally, I will take this all on me, personally, do not believe that after 25 years of listening to these stories, that some light bells couldn't have gone off, that sexual violence occurred. Such as, for example, there were children born in detention. So we know that there was sexual acts. I mean, we just don't know whether they were illicit or not. But an investigator might have wanted to say, well, let me find out, was that illicit or non-illicit? So, I mean, that narrative, again, you know, investigator, prosecutor coming together and understanding what occurred is important. And then lastly, the Guatemalan case. You showed the case on the sexual violence. There was the other Guatemalan case on the genocide with the Xil Mayan Indians, who also for 20, 25 years, the narrative was it was about killings. It was not about sexual violence. And these are some of the cases now that have gone out about the Guatemalan sexual violence that was tied within the armed conflict and the killing.
Perhaps just as well, Max, you mentioned Rhonda. I don't know whether everybody in the room would have known what the reference was. This was Rhonda Copeland, who was, again, at the very beginning at the time, the Tadic case and earlier, and there was a great deal of writing on a lot of these doctrinal issues and how to push matters forward.
Yeah.
So that's Copeland. She's, many people in the room would have known her, but again, certainly somebody whose work you should be looking at.
Definitely.
Okay, questions, comments? Yeah. And as before, we'll take two or three in a bundle, if you could say who you are.
Thank you. Thank you so much for these very interesting comments. My name is Gaia Pergola. I'm a legal officer with Redress. I have a question in regard to this idea of success and empowerment. I really like this idea of thinking about the law as a tool to empower people. And I think if we were able to achieve that, I think we would really have to be proud of ourselves. However, my question is more towards how do you ensure success in this light beyond Judgment Day? We saw these incredible images, and they're so powerful, so, you know, very, very important. But how do we make sure that these judgments or these achievements or developments in jurisprudence are then not left in a vacuum, meaning that the society and the patterns or, like, dynamics in society then would not defeat the purpose of this important achievement in the law? And we see this a lot in our work as well. Sometimes we get very positive decisions, but then it's very challenging to implement those decisions in the countries because the state is, you know, of course, not willing to collaborate. It's very difficult to reach out to victim communities and all of the rest. So how do you see that in your experiences or going forward in different scenarios in the, across the world? Thank you.
Thank you. Other? Yeah.
Max, my name is Lada Sholian, ICTY. Max, a question for you. One of the last comments that you made was about adapting to the victims. And I was curious if you had some concrete ideas about how a national, you know, national institutions could, criminal institutions could, in fact, adapt, and what would be examples of that? Thanks.
You could think that's right, too. Yeah.
Thank you. My name is Veronica Inestros. I'm from Colombia, and I'm a consultant on human rights and transitional justice. My question is for Maxine. You were talking about do no harm and the importance of listening to the victims and what they actually, how their own understanding of what happened. But in the context of Colombia, I'm with time finding very difficult to really identify the narrative of the victim. It can, you know, when you get so much international cooperation and so many people working in the ground with the victims, you don't know anymore, you know, if it's really the victim talking, and at some point you start listening to the same speech from different victims independently. So it's more of a comment, but of course I would love to hear your thoughts about it.
Any others in this round? Yeah.
Good morning, my name is Zara. I work for the AIR Center. Thank you very much to all the speakers, and I would like to say that so far it's a really great day for me. I have two questions, very short. So one is about forced pregnancies, and then the second point is I recently went to Srebrenica myself, and I got the privilege to speak to the mothers, the survivors of the genocide. And I was wondering if you could say, I mean, if for you this is a good example of empowerment for the society there. I mean, what the actions, what they are trying to do and try to raise awareness, try to be involved.
In which context? The mothers of Srebrenica.
Yes.
Yes. Yeah. The mothers of Srebrenica.
Yeah. Thank you.
And we'll take one more and then come back to, yeah.
I'm Mufu Malami Kora. I'm a researcher, PhD researcher from the School of Advanced Legal Studies. Talking about prosecuting the victims of the perpetrators of sexual violence, there appears to be no mention of the secondary victims. Those are the children born of war. I wonder if that's taken into consideration when you're charging the perpetrators. And also, I've come across the concept of forgive and forget. I wonder how that ties in with the prosecutions. I don't know if that's clear. My question is clear, you know? Forgiveness, how does that come in, the issue of forgiveness? How is it treated, or what's your thinking? What's your thinking about that?
I'll take none of them are easy, but let me take one that are maybe a little less.
I don't think any of the issues are easy.
A little less complicated. A question concerning Colombia. I understand what you're saying because often the survivor slash victim has been spoken to by so many times, asked to repeat the story so many times, you know, what is their narrative? Well, I think my experience is that even within the repetition, there is truth within their narrative. At times their narrative has been restated to frame or to reflect whom they're speaking to. And one has to be very cautious of that. But the essence of what is being related in many ways is their narrative. And then with, and this is where an excellent investigator is someone who has human skills and a competency of how to pull out and clarify what that person means to say about a certain issue. I mean, these are part of the panoply of investigative skills. They're not necessarily the skills that persons at NGOs are trained to have. They might be trained to have skills to get a story and then how to advocate for part of that story on behalf of a larger group or how to educate a larger public. So I think that competent investigators do pull out a better narrative, okay? The question is, and I think the challenge is too, is that narrative is in lay terms, and that's where it's supposed to be in lay terms. I mean, if any potential witness came up to me and said, well, I'd like you to charge forced sterilization because someone conducted another inhumane act against me while we were being attacked by a widespread and systematic.
Whoa, hold up, okay.
So I think that sometimes we're looking at language that is might appear very simple but might have broader implications. And to the question of forgiveness, particularly in the ICTY system, I think we go only as far as what might be mitigating circumstances. Whether the perpetrator has asked for forgiveness, or whether the perpetrator in some manner has made an advancement to look for a form of reconciliation. But it's neither a legal requirement that has to be put forward, nor is it something that the judges have to instate. Within the broader panoply now of reparations, maybe there's something that comes in that is a counterpart to seeking a form of saying I'm sorry, and maybe that'll be a reciprocal process on behalf of the victims, but it's certainly not required in any way.
Okay, how do we make sure that any successes are not left behind in the background? You know, I think it takes a lot of creativity and a broader vision than just obviously focusing on the judgment. I can just give you a couple of examples. One is the Rios Montt case, which we were talking about, which is a genocide where the former president was convicted for genocide. But then the judgment was quashed by the Constitutional Court on a procedural issue. Okay, we can debate that one. The point is the former president was convicted for genocide. And in the community, the affected community where the issue are, they celebrate every year the anniversary of the date that he was convicted. Now, the case was quashed, it's in a retrial, or they're trying, or he's sick, or I don't know, but the point is, right, they viewed it as a victory. So I think, you know, it's there, they do that. You know, we learn from them. How do they celebrate it? That's how they celebrate it. Maybe it was overturned on a political reason, and that did not undermine the fact that there was this conviction. Another way is, you know, I mean, I've highlighted a lot of really positive things. There are obviously there's a long way to go. You know, I don't want to say it's all rosy. And one example, in the Seprosarco case in Guatemala, the courts don't have a system of simultaneous interpretation. Let me just repeat that. The courts don't have a system of simultaneous interpretation. Does anyone know what percentage of the population of Guatemala is Mayan and does not speak Spanish? 80% or something, 70 or 80%. Okay, so, you know, somebody thought of bringing an interpreter, and the interpreter came for the witness standing next to the. Okay, ultimately, this was a bit of an embarrassment and some funding came, and but it was on an ad hoc basis. The courts do not provide it. So access to the audience was filled with victims from different communities who couldn't follow the proceedings in Spanish because there was no broadcast, there was no, you couldn't go into the audience and hear it, and there's no booth, whatever, even if it's not a booth, there's no, not like even the Habre case, the translation, the guy was on the loudspeaker translating, okay, so you can criticize that too, but at least it was a constant running on the record, broadcast, recorded translation that everybody can hear in court and online, right, but not, and not in Guatemala, and nobody made a motion for that. So that would be a way to bring the impact to the whole community, a real impact. Now, the impact was brought. Civil society brought it a lot, and there was a very big impact. But think of the impact you could have if it was translated into Achi and Kekchi and all the indigenous languages. Okay, in terms of adapting, I mean, the best example of adapting is the example from Sierra Leone, where, and many contexts, where you deal with traditional belief systems, customary belief systems, sorcery, if you will. I don't like to use that term, but just to click in exactly what we're talking about. I mean, the group that I was investigating were fighters, and in order, as part of their military preparation, they had a bulletproofing ceremony in the bush, and they were rendered bulletproof. And so every witness was going to come to court and testify that they saw the bullets bounce off the bodies of the combatants after they were bulletproofed. So how do you judge credibility? But we all lived there. And if you had said that kind of a belief system makes the witness inherently incredible, you would have had no witnesses. You know, I mean, even in one of the arrest operations, they were arresting the high priest, the chief initiator, who was the guy who did all these bulletproofing ceremonies, and he was prosecuted for his role in the criminal plan because he bulletproofed the combatants. And to prepare them for battle, and upon arresting him, the most trained special forces in Sierra Leone, trained by the Brits, paused. They hesitated at his arrest because he was the high priest. They were like, he was the high priest. So, it's a belief system. So the international justice process has to adapt to that. There's no way that we can apply the rules of credibility that you would apply in a Dutch court, right? It just won't work. So now there's a limit, of course. There's a limit, and that's what needs to be assessed through the process. But there had to be a much more dynamic view of how do you assess credibility in the context in which the community lives in. And I would think that that's much harder to do from a remote location than from an on-site or close to on-site venue. The Mothers of Srebrenica, yeah, maybe Michelle can talk to that, or somebody else can talk to that. I don't know if I can comment on the Mothers of Srebrenica, but the forced pregnancy, the way it's defined, is pretty limiting, right?
Right.
The crime of forced pregnancy, we don't have jurisprudence on it yet, but the definition of it, you know, the forcible confinement of a woman forcibly made pregnant.
To change the ethnicity.
To change the ethnicity. Or commit some other grave violation. So it seems to be about confinement.
Confinement
and ethnicity.
Rather than yeah.
It doesn't criminalize necessarily pregnancies resulting from rape. It's not a straight,
much narrower.
But does somebody else have anything
to... One last question. I mean, not one last question, but the one thing about the children born of the sexual violence, that children born of illegal sexual violence, that's something that the international courts and tribunals have not looked at. I mean, I think that's part of the avenue, or the part of the future of investigation and prosecution. And one of the areas in which it just jumps out at you are the children that have been born from the forced marriages, which I call enslavement in the Cambodia situation. Many of those children now are in their 30s, because if you're born as a result of enslavement, then what is the status of that little kid? Well, actually, it's another slave. You know, two slaves beget a slave. And in the Cambodia situation, the reason the children were born, the reason the parents were supposed to have sexual relationship, was in essence to produce a child. The Khmer Rouge were actually breeding children so they could be placed in a different political system to be part of the new Khmer. So those children, what crimes occurred against them by the very fact that they were born, and then what crimes occurred against them by the very fact that they were born to be transferred to another group? In this instance, a political group, so we don't really hit the definition of genocide, but is there something in terms of persecution, or is genocide too limited? So this is all for future analysis and litigation, I would think.
Michelle, are you on the mother's service, sir?
So the question, I think, was on the mother's.
Sorry, where is the mic?
Yeah.
I don't like to leave something, just hang it.
Yes. If I recall, the question was, are the mothers of Srebrenica an example of empowerment through the justice process?
Yes.
Yeah. And it's an interesting point. I mean, of course, we've had extensive dealings with the mothers of Srebrenica in our office over the years. I mean, of course, they've been an incredibly important component of civil society in advocating for justice, advocating for the arrests of key fugitives over many, many years. And so certainly to see the way that they've been able to advocate, to influence the international community would certainly suggest that there has been a process of empowerment. But again, it's a question that I think we would really need to put to them as to hear their own perception and experiences. I think they, like everybody, struggle with the same thing, you know, access to funding for the work that they do. You know, I think, in fact, the two of you may have been involved in the Women's Court that they were also involved in setting up. I know, you know, it was an ongoing battle to try and get the funding for that. So it continues to be difficult, but they certainly do stand out for us as an incredibly impressive, articulate and, just really well-positioned commentators on all the work that we do, and they put us under immense pressure all the time, which is great. And we have really welcomed that, and I think Prosecutor Bramitz in particular has been really extremely mindful of the important role that they play, which is a positive thing.
Thank you. I'd like to thank all the speakers. Well, thank Michelle again as well, and thank you for all the questions.